To the Adoption Show, Voices Ending the Myth, for Sunday, December 24th, 2006. You are here with Michelle Edmonds, your host, and Thaddeus Pedro, our recording producer. And Thaddeus and I would like to wish you all
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. And whatever it is that you do in this holiday season, we wish you all the best. And yeah, happy celebrations. Right, Thaddeus?
You're funny.
Sometimes you nod off. I know. I have to give you a little nudge every once in a while. Hey, Thaddeus, listen. I went to visit Santa this year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I had to ask him for something.
And what did you ask him?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I asked for, like, you know, Mucklocks and the game Clue, stuff like that.
Did you say Matlock?
No, Mucklocks.
Oh, I thought you said
they're
you
like
asked
these fluffy, fluffy white boots. No, they're coming back now. I see people wearing them. They're those boots that are really like fluffy and fuzzy.
I see.
They're like Eskimo
shoes.
Yeah, something like that. Sometimes I swear you just say these things. Okay, so Santa said, you know, what can I do for you this year, and how can I help you, young lady?
Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah, ho, ho, ho. And I asked him if I could have my birth certificate. And he said, well, have you been a good girl this year?
And what did you say?
I said, no. Well, Santa, I told Santa what's up, and he said, it's okay, don't worry about it.
Did he say, ho, ho, ho?
Yeah, a few times.
My point exactly.
Well, it is Christmas. What does Santa talk about the rest of the year?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, must be pretty boring. Mm.
Well, I did see, I'm not sure if it's actually real, but what was that movie called again? It just recently came out.
About Santa?
Yeah, it was Santa Claus, and it was something along the lines of that, right?
Oh, like what he does the rest of the year?
Yeah, like what he was just doing to prepare for Christmas, actually, but it was,
Was it a kid's movie?
Yeah, I see it with my little sister, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, like with Tim Allen?
That's who
it
was.
Oh, right.
The Tool Man.
The Santa Claus, yeah, right.
The Santa Claus, there you go.
Oh, so when he's not making
it was about
presents.
Mrs. Claus having
an affair?
Child.
Oh, and a child? A child?
A child.
Oh, out of wedlock?
From Matlock?
Did
what?
She get sent to a maternity home?
I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Matlock, wedlock. Oh, dear. Now, there's a story.
Yeah, it was good.
Mrs. Claus goes to a maternity home.
It was really good. Don't forget to check it out.
Okay. There's a good plug for the Santa Claus. Santa Claus movie. Okay, so our topic tonight on this Christmas Eve is foster care. And we have three guests, John Dunn, Jesse McVicker, and Erica Klein, all of whom grew up in the foster care system. And it's just, you know what, our brothers and sisters, we're all part of the same system. It's just that we went to, some of us were adopted and others went through the system from home to home. And just craziness, just crazy, crazy, crazy lives these people have led. And the system that was removed them from their homes for to protect them actually ended up causing more harm than good. Okay, now we have John Dunn on the line. John is the Executive Director of the Foster Care Council of Canada. And John is a former Crown Ward. He was placed into foster care by the Catholic Children's Aid when he was around 18
months
old. And he lived throughout 16 years of his life, he lived in 13 different foster homes and experienced much abuse throughout those homes. So John is here to talk about his life in foster care and how he came to be the executive director of the Foster Care Council of Canada. So hi, John.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, I'm great.
Good. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. I really wanted to be on it, so I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, you've also been on TV in the past little while, and well, throughout the years, TV and radio, talking about the child welfare system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so can you also just give listeners a bit of your background?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, as you introduced me there, I went into care when I was 18 months old because my mom at the time was alcoholic and suffering from bipolar disorder. And my brother, I have two older sisters and an older brother and myself. So we all actually got separated at that time. And then when I was about four, I was reunited with my brother. So my brother and I moved through foster homes together. But I didn't meet my sisters again, nor my mother, until I was 10 years old. So my brother and I went through all those foster homes together until I was 13. And then we were separated when I was 13. And I didn't see him again until, I think it was something like 9 years later. And just by fluke downtown Toronto, I met him when I was applying for a job. And the ironic thing is I was applying for a job as a bike courier, and he was actually working for the company I was applying for.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty cool how we met there that day.
Yeah. Interesting, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and can you talk about what life was like in the various foster homes?
There were, like, a couple of them were sort of long-term. There was the first one I was in was the Halowskis. I just remember their name, Halowski, but it was an older lady, and it was a pretty nice place. I just remember being there, and it was kind of uneventful. And then we moved to Trout Creek, and we lived in a home there for about 4 years. And that was the one where things didn't work out so well. We were supposed to be adopted, and they had what they called, I guess, an adoption breakdown or something like that. It was we were placed there for adoption, but when my brother and I were, I guess, reporting what was happening to us there, they decided just to keep us there as foster kids, not adoptive kids. And some of the things that were happening was that my brother had been abused while he was there because of soiling.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know this yet, but he had shown me how to how to hold your bowel movement long enough that you wouldn't have to. I guess it was just for holding it, because he was scared to go to the washroom and stuff. So
okay.
What I did is, one day I had gone to the washroom as well, and I just had a large bowel movement, whatever, and it flooded the toilet. So the foster father came along, and he was yelling at me about it, and he grabbed my head, and he stuffed my head in the toilet and flushed it. So, you know, and I was about 6 years old when that happened.
God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that ended up becoming a long-term issue, because I then had a bizarre fear of toilets for years after that.
Mm-hmm. I bet, yeah.
Yeah.
And so was the Catholic Children's Aid making regular visits to this home while you and your brother were there?
I don't actually remember them being there at all. I'm sure they probably made a couple, but in 4 years, I mean, it certainly wasn't a regular thing. I don't remember even seeing them there, other than when they came to take us away.
Right. Okay. So you were there for 4 years before they came in and took you.
Yes.
Okay. And did you know why you were being taken from that home?
At the time, I didn't. What it was I was actually at school, and a social worker drove up to the school, and I got called to the office. So I went down to the office, and I saw a social worker there, and that was it. Off I went, and we didn't get told why or anything. And being young, I didn't know why, because it wasn't just on an incident, right? It was over time, a bunch of incidents.
Yes, of course.
So, yeah, I just remember leaving in the car and thinking about my friends, and, you know, like, that I wouldn't be able to see my friends again.
Right, of course. And they didn't even take you back to the house?
No, never went back.
Just from school and then to another home?
Yes.
And what was that home like?
From Trout Creek, we went to We went to a temporary home in Callander, which is somewhere just a few kilometers north or south of there. And that place was good. It was another non-eventful place, but I was there for probably a winter or something, I think, or a couple of months anyway, in the winter. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we moved down to Scarborough, I think it was, and moved into another foster home there, where we stayed for like 3 or 4 years, almost 4 years with them, until I was 10 or something like that, 10. Yeah, sorry, until I was 13. But what happened is while we were there, this was a good home actually in Scarborough that we lived with, and we had a 6-month trial visit with our mother.
Okay.
So we were actually able to go home for a 6-month period, but it didn't work out because, you know, my mom was used to living alone now, and to suddenly have two boys popped into her house, you know, no support that I remember anybody being there. It just didn't work out with all of us. So, and my brother and I had our own issues from being abused in care and all this other stuff. So, mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's when we got separated. I ended up going back to the LeBretons' home for another year or so, and my brother went somewhere else, and I just didn't see him after that. That was the last time I saw him.
For another 9 or something years?
Yep. Yeah. And it was just because I happened to apply for a job where he worked that I found him. Mm-hmm. So they didn't make any effort to try and keep us together or in contact or anything.
Yeah, not even by the telephone, you know, wonderful invention.
Yep.
Okay, so what was happening to you? Like, I mean, obviously you wouldn't have known it at the time, but in retrospect, what was happening to you inside being, you know, transferred to all these different homes and...
Mm-hmm. Well, like you said, you wouldn't know it at the time because you're just sort of going day by day and doing your thing and learning the new rules and the new homes and all that kind of emotional stuff that, you know, I kind of just figured that that's the way life is, you know, so I started to adapt to it. Not that that's a good thing, because adapting meant just realizing that, okay, I'm going to make friends, but I'm not going to keep any friends. Probably lose them again, and, you know, but you still make friends anyway, so it's hard not to attach to people you hang out with all day at school.
Exactly, so, and that's how you were becoming, how you were starting to view the world.
Yeah, but there's, you know, you don't really stay anywhere or anything like that for a long time.
Yeah,
I guess as an adult too, the way it affected my relationships and life is that I didn't really attach to people as much as I attached to places for some reason.
Okay.
And I look back at my life as like a whole series of little time zones. You know, they're like frozen time zones where. If you think back, like some people think of a place that's familiar to them, you know, a park or something like that, and it's like, oh yeah, this park, whatever. And they go through it all the time, they grow up at the cottage, and everything has familiar memories, and they can, you know, look back and have nostalgia, and, you know. But with me, when I go back and I think of a place I was at, it's not just a nostalgic memory, it's painful because you miss the people that you lost there, you know?
Right.
So it was like a constant mourning, I guess, is how it felt.
Oh, wow.
Always moving and always, anytime you go back to what was even a good memory, it became a painful thing to remember the good things, even.
Right. I understand what you're saying, yeah. Like, most people stay with one family.
Yeah.
And, of course, in adoption, I guess, generally we stay with one family, but in foster care, you're attaching and detaching.
Yeah.
And
there's house rules, like the things that people don't think about is, you know, getting used to all the rules in the house. You know, am I allowed to get up and go to the bathroom at 10 o'clock at night? You know, is the floor going to squeak? Am I going to wake someone up? Can I flush the toilet? Like, all these questions, you know, that you don't think about.
And how were you treated in these various foster homes? Like, was it, to me, it's just got to be bizarre going into somebody's house where everything's set up and there's a family and there's a family dynamic and there's a, you know, an ambiance to that house, to that home, and you're just sort of plopped there and you have to adjust.
Yeah, that's something at a time, like you said, you don't think about it at the time, but when you look back, you really do realize how much how much of an impact there is. Because you, if like you said, if you take yourself right now as an adult and you go into someone's house, you know, the way you act in their house, you act different than you do at home because you're comfortable at home and
sure.
all that. So there's the whole, like, tiptoeing around kind of mentality, you know, like, am I allowed to sit here? Can I touch this? Can mm-hmm. I, you know, what?
Can I open the fridge? Can
yeah.
I, yeah.
Am I allowed to get food?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And so what did you call the people? Like, did you call them
we
mom and dad or their first names?
We called mom and dad, and that was the LeBretons.
Oh.
They were great. But the rest of them were just the names of the parents.
Like Mr. and Mrs.?
No.
No, their first names?
It was just the first name basis, usually.
Right, okay. Yeah. And did any of them have children, like their own children?
A couple did, yeah. One was a family-style group home.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two of their own children. And this was when I was a teenager. I moved there when I was 13. And stayed there for 3 or 4 years. And that's where more abuse went on, mostly emotional abuse or verbal abuse and a lot of physical abuse with the other guys because I was just not the type to be aggressive or, you know, so I didn't really fight back as much.
Okay.
But that place was basically the worst one of all, 4 years living there. And,
Okay, and so where was the Catholic Children's Aid? Like how often were they coming into your life? Were they?
I don't remember seeing them a lot in my life, other than during a move. So when I was older, though, in the group home, I remember seeing him a little bit more, and it was probably on a schedule. But it was I'd say maybe once every 6 months or so, something like that.
Okay.
And I don't even remember it really being that regular, but it probably was.
Right.
And it was just like a meeting in the living room. And you're with the foster parent or the group home parent, you're with the worker and yourself. So there's no I don't remember there being any privacy where I could speak alone to my worker.
Exactly. That was my next question.
Okay.
If you wanted to report something or disclose something to the worker that you weren't comfortable with in that home, did you feel safe to do that?
No. Because just the fact that you're in the room with the guy that's doing this, you know, and they did give us this booklet, right? There's the book of your rights and stuff. And this is something I think is really important today and one of the things I want to work on in the future. By law, the kids are supposed to know their rights. So they give you this little booklet that says you have a right to speak to the ombudsman and all this other stuff. Or not the ombudsman, the child advocate. But once you get that little booklet in hand, one day when you're young, you've got it and you think, okay, that's cool. And then you go and you put it in your drawer or wherever it goes. That's it. You know, like to use the telephone, you have to be in front of them and you have to ask them to use the phone.
Right.
So again, there's another privacy issue. And then the fear of, you know, when I do tell, well, what's going to happen? Are they going to come down on me? Am I going to be taken away? You know, so, the, you know,
mm-hmm.
But calling in itself is a problem.
Always a fear.
Yeah,
kind of fear of something.
In fear almost the whole time.
Exactly. Okay, and so how old were you when you left your last foster home?
I was actually 18, and I was given the choice. They sort of sat me down for a couple meetings and prepared me and said, you know, you have the option to stay until you're older, I think up to 24. But at the time, I had been through so much and already moved so many times, I was ready to go. Like, I just didn't want to be bothered with that anymore. I just wanted to, you know, make my own decisions, and off I went. And it was just, that was it. Once you're gone, you're out, and there's no going back. There's no asking for help, you're out.
Right.
So I went out, and I spent the next 15 years or so moving through something like 60 jobs almost that I've counted over time, just using a formula of I usually last anywhere from 3 to 6 months on a job, and it's because I guess I was never taught how to deal with issues or how to deal with people properly. So if someone's telling me what to do, that's fine, but when they kind of get a little bit abusive about it, I didn't know what to do. I'd either just, you know, argue with them and leave, or, you know, quit and walk away. And that's probably what I had learned all my life in care from moving.
Right.
If there was a problem, you leave.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and who had been advocating for you all those years? Nobody.
Not that I know of, yeah. The workers who moved me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't remember anyone ever sitting with me and saying, hey, you know, how are you feeling? Or I was never talked to. You know how, you know, when kids go to bed, you chat with them, you read a book, and you ask them how your day was. You know, I don't remember any of that ever happening in my life as a kid, up until 18 even.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now I met you when you were, what, about 29 or 30 years old?
Yes.
Yes, okay. And you had tried to contact the Catholic Children's Aid, mm-hmm. Just seeking help.
Yes. What it was is all of a sudden I was feeling alone. I was frustrated with losing jobs, and I was just, you know, tired of it, all the years of going through that and losing apartments, and I'd moved something like 35 times by that point. So I was actually going to go check myself in at 999 Queen to see what the hell's wrong with me. You know, this is not normal.
Mm-hmm. Which is a mental health facility.
Sorry, yeah. It's a mental health facility. So I was going to go in, not that anyone said I should, but I just wanted to go and figure what the hell, you know, what's going on. So I went in, and I just said that I think I'm ADHD or something because, you know, I was on Ritalin as a kid. So they sent me to the Clark Institute, or they were going to send me there for an evaluation,
mm-hmm.
but they were booked, 2 years waiting, and they weren't taking any more. So I went to another place. This is like, you know, again, here's someone trying to go for help, and look what they go through. Then I went to a place down on St. Mike's, I think it is, on Queen Street East. And when I asked a doctor there, I said, look, you know, I just want to get testing and everything. She made me feel like I was looking for drugs.
Oh.
Like I wanted drugs because I had long hair, and I guess she just made an assumption, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, the last thing I want is drugs. I just want to figure out what's wrong and how I can deal with it. And the way she, you know, treated me was just sent me over the top there. I was like, oh my God. So anyways, I did reach out. I went to the Catholic Children's Aid and I said, look, I'd like to make a connection with my past and sort of see what happened to me and why I'm turning out this way. So I asked for copies of my files, and that's when this whole 5 years of advocacy started. And they just said, no, we can't give you copies.
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave me the process. You have to make the request in writing. So I did that, sent a letter saying I'd like access to my files. And the only way they'll let you do it is you have to go in to the building, and you can have what they call a social history. Well, you obviously know this,
mm-hmm.
But they do a social history, which is a worker will look at your files and then type up a story from the files. And what I was told is that they do it because they don't think you're, I guess, intelligent enough to understand how to read the files. So they put it in a story. This is what the executive director told me. That they do it because it's easier for you to read them. And I said, well, I want to see the files themselves. I'm not trying to get a story here. I want to see what's in my files and my history. But there was no budging. They weren't. I've been fighting them for 5 years to get copies of them, and there's nothing so far.
Right, and they also white out all the names, correct?
Yeah, they blanked out all foster parents' names, all brothers and siblings, all foster brothers and siblings, and doctors, dentists, any names like that, teachers, they had all the names blanked out in them.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think they do that?
My thought was that it was privacy issues, right? And that's what they claim. But then when I kept persisting, I got it right from the executive director of the Catholic Children's Aid. She told Mary McConville at the time. And she said, the reason we do it is because we fear that you might cause harm to any of the third parties in the files.
Mm.
And that was, you know, just, I thought, you know, how can they assume that all Crown Wards or former Crown Wards are going to be violent or aggressive? And if that is their assumption, then maybe they're doing something wrong.
Well, exactly, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was unbelievable, you know, to be fighting for 5 years just to get access to my files.
Mm-hmm. Come on, John, you were plotting something against a dentist, weren't you?
Yeah. I've hated dentists all my life. I'm kidding. Yeah. It's unbelievable. And I found out that according to Section 148 of the Child and Family Services Act, I think it was, which hasn't been put into, it hasn't been enacted yet, mm-hmm. it actually says that they can blank out names, but not doctors and psychologists or something like that, not medical names.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, it's your right as a citizen, as a taxpayer, to be able to act, to be able to obtain any information that is written about you
right.
by any professional.
Yeah.
So whether, regardless if you grew up in foster care or not, like, it's your information written about you.
Yeah. So. And but the Children's Aids, their files are actually outside of the privacy legislation,
mm-hmm.
and they... I read in the Hansard years ago that there was a debate about it, or not a debate, but a committee hearing on it, and they discussed the fact that there are sensitive files and sensitive information, and this is what they've, I guess, you know, the legislators were probably well-intended, but what they don't realize is that there's years and years of actual emotional and physical abuse of kids in care being hidden in these files because of that.
That's right. And I guess that's why they they want the names kept private, because if you went to visit that psychologist or dentist, you're going to see it right in your file that this child was abused.
Yes. No. So. And then, I mean, what if you're going to do legal action? I believe, that was my original belief too, is that the reason they keep the file secret is because they don't want kids, former kids in care coming back with legal action.
Of course.
I mean, they're actually denying you your right to access to the law or access to justice
mm-hmm.
by not letting you obtain these files.
That's right. Well, it's my opinion, too, that that's what they're trying to do. So, because certainly there's enough lawsuits going on right now, and there have been in the past from people who were severely, severely abused while
yes.
in the care of Children's AIDS, yeah. And they did nothing, but just, you know, negligent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you started the Foster Care Council of Canada,
right?
Well, it was called something else, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just I think I originally called it Welcome Home.
Oh,
way back, yeah, before right. just before I met you.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, what did I do? I was just using it as a website to reach out and find other Crown wards who've been in to see if. You know, am I suffering this alone, or is, you know, is this normal for us?
Yeah.
So that's how it all started.
And so people, so it's been 5 years.
Yes.
Yeah. And so how many people would you say you've reached out to, or people who have come to you in that time?
Oh, God, I've talked to, you know, including email and by phone and in person, it's got to be hundreds by now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I walked up to the East Coast.
Yes, I was just going to bring that up.
Records
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked out to the East Coast protesting that they wouldn't give us access to our records. And along the way there, I talked to people in restaurants who are, you know, like just frontline workers in a restaurant, fast food joints, and they were, you know, I met one guy who said the same thing, and this was in New Brunswick, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just here in Ontario. This is happening all across Canada.
Oh, North America.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And so can you also talk about Bill 210?
Yes, that was legislation that came, I think it was introduced in June 05, was it?
I think, yeah, just after Bill 183, the adoption bill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was introduced, and what it was, what it appears to be, and hopefully is, but we'll see, is there... going to be offering basically open adoptions now in Ontario through the changes in Bill 210. So there'll be alternate, I can't remember the exact wording, but there's going to be, you can have kinship care and kids can go and live with siblings and stuff instead of having to go into foster care. Unfortunately, the reason it was done isn't for, you know, to protect the children, it's finances, because the budget is just going out of whack. It's $1.3 billion a year or something now.
And for what though? For foster care?
Yeah.
Okay.
For child welfare. So because of the financial strain, they're trying to look for alternative means of caring for kids now that won't cost as much money.
Okay. So, but just okay. Give an example then. of what that would look like? If a child is apprehended,
yes.
Okay, which means taken from their mother and father and put into foster care. So what will be the difference now?
Okay, well, what it was like before, they'd obviously be apprehended, taken into care, and then, you know, they do the investigation and kind of see where it goes from there. And what they're going to do now is they can take a child from that home still, and they can look for alternate sources than foster homes, so they can put them with a grandmother or a cousin or a, you know, someone in their community. If they're in a native community, they can go to their band or something like that. And that home will have to go through as well rigorous, you know, background checks and police checks and all that as well. But they don't have to go into a stranger's home anymore, hopefully. But I have a feeling that it's also going to be an issue, because these background checks are going to be probably finding, you know, that the people aren't quite perfect enough, and then they'll have to make alternate plans anyhow. So that's something I'll be watching for, but hopefully it works out for the better.
Right, okay. So Bill 210 isn't necessarily a positive change to the child welfare system?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's sort of, I think, in the right direction, but it's... I also have a fear that it might actually enable more adoptions, because before Bill 210, you could not adopt someone if the parents had access to the child. So a kid gets taken into care, and they're going to be set up for adoption, they have to cut the family ties in order for them to adopt legally.
Exactly.
Even if it's beneficial to maintain the relationship.
Right. So it's kind of like fast-tracking adoptions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what that means to me is that there's going to be a push on to get children out of homes and quickly adopted.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be their new mandate.
Yes.
They'll
and
be funded.
Last year, the Minister of Children and Youth Services, believe it or not, had, and I don't know the name of the document, but I can produce it for you if you need it, a 15% increase was recommended by the Minister for adoptions. They actually wanted, they were pushing all the children's aides to do a 15% increase in adoptions.
Right. Good grief.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then this change happens, so, I mean, when you look at it, it's kind of scary what they might be coming up to.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Okay, and also another part of Bill 210 that was, there was a big ruckus about, was accountability.
Yes.
Because, like you said, CASs, Children's Aid Societies, and I think in the United States, too, Child Protection Services, they're outside of the law.
Yes.
They're outside of the legislature.
Yes.
And so they're accountable to no one. Their own review board is in-house.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your position around CASs and accountability?
I mean, it's just as you said, the same thing. They will always claim, and the Ontario Association of Children's Aid Societies says it as well, that they have, you know, all these various measures of accountability in place. They have their internal reviews. They got the Child and Family Services Review Board, which in itself is, I think, potentially just a piece of fluff. But I haven't been through it, so I don't know. But I've heard enough stories that they're very limited in their scope and what they can review. They also use, which you won't, well, yeah, you'll probably believe it. They use people who benefit from adoptions, lawyers who do adoption, practitioners, to do reviews of adoption complaints. And
okay.
So, you know, someone who actually profits from adoption,
right,
doing reviews of a complaint about the way their child was apprehended or something, so they'll assign, the ministry can assign a director to review a complaint.
Wow, nothing.
And those quote-unquote assigned directors are appointed by the ministry, and they're usually lawyers and mm-hmm. stuff who are involved in adoption.
Exactly. There's. It seems like everything is just kept inside, behind their walls.
Mm-hmm.
The less they have to bring in outsiders, the better it is.
Yes, and that became really apparent during the Bill 210's review, or sorry, during the committee hearings, when Section 68 was the issue that we're talking about. Section 68 is where the Children's Aid has to make a complaints procedure available to clients.
Okay.
And when Bill 210 came along, they actually reduced it. Originally, the three or four stages were you first have to talk to your worker and try and work it out, the one that you're complaining about, so you have to go straight to that person, which is intimidating if you're scared of them or whatever the deal is. Mm-hmm. So there's another issue in itself. Then you had to escalate it to that worker supervisor, and then from that point you go up to the executive director, and then after that, if you still don't like what the result has been, or if it's just been, you know, ignored and said go ahead to the next stage, which usually happens, then you go to the board of directors and you can have a meeting with them. And they don't usually give you the whole board of directors. They'll have one or two of them come as a I guess a committee or something.
Yes.
And you speak with them, and then they make a decision, and then if you don't agree with that, then they assign a director to review it. So that's how it used to be. When Bill 210 first came in, they were going to remove the director level and the board of directors level from the review process. So it was just going to be worker, supervisor, executive director, and that's it. So this is where we really got, this was great, like Bill 183 had a great, I don't know what you call it, like a movement, you know, people got active, they got involved, and they made change happen, right?
Yes.
So finally, Bill 210 did the same thing when Section 68 came in. I heard about it, I made a lot of noise, I called the ombudsman, I sent letters to him, I put a whole document into the committee about it, saying why I thought it wasn't a good idea, and then we actually got a lot of people involved, and everybody else spread the word, and this is what we need to always do. People forget that, you know, the legislature, they just see it as a government garbage, people fighting on TV, no big deal. But it's actually, those are the people that you have to talk to, and you have to try to convince them, or at least show them what it's like and experience, so they can realize that, wow, you know, this needs change.
Well, these are the laws that are implemented that affect us, you know, so, yeah, if you don't speak up, then nothing will happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's been great this time around, so, yeah, Bill 210 got the, or Section 68 anyway in Bill 210 got the attention it needed this time. I looked in prior Hansard, the old logs of all the goings-on at Parliament, and the last time there were reviews in 99 and 98, I think it was, or 97, all the prior ones, I read through all the people who came to the committee hearings, and it was always professionals only. So it was, you know, the internal loop, you know?
Right.
But this time we had a lot of public delegates coming in, and it's great.
Yeah, thanks to people like you.
And yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but it, you know what, John? It's hard work bringing awareness to any kind of injustice, right?
Yeah.
Because people are so brainwashed. They're so conditioned. There's so much fear. And especially if you've had dealings with the child welfare system, like you say, it's very intimidating.
Yes.
You know, because when you grow up with a social policy or social law that prevents you from even knowing who your family is, How do you gather the strength to go fight this or these people?
Well,
you know, it's, and that's why you and your organization, like after Foster Care Council of Canada, are so amazing, because you're giving people a voice, right? You're saying, hey, it's okay to speak out, to be angry.
Yes, and that's the one thing that everyone has to be careful of, and I'm sure you've dealt with it yourself, is of course we're angry, and we're justifiably angry, right, and hurt and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
What they do and the way they treat you once you've left, I mean, these are your quote-unquote former parents, right? Your
right.
family, so to speak. And when you go back to them, they treat you like you're there to rob your house, you know? Like,
exactly.
They lock you out, they shut you down, they label you as aggressive or this or that, or just because you're telling them, like, I'm hurt and here's... And I've never been violent or aggressive to them, and I've had them label me as a loose cannon. You know, and I know better. Like, I know if I go and blab off and swear and do all this other stuff or threaten them, I'm going to lose my chance to get any kind of cooperation.
Right.
You know? So I'm quite aware of it and careful about it. So that's something everybody needs to be aware of, too, is you don't have to be wimpy, right? But you got to be strong, you got to be sturdy, and keep going without being aggressive in order to get any kind of progress, because what they try to do is make you snap. You know, they frustrate you and they turn you around and they make you look like you're wrong and you're doing something bad and, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know. It's good to realize that they are just people. They are not the law.
Mm-hmm.
They are just people called social workers. And they've been given too much power. That's pretty evident nowadays, right?
Yep.
There's just too many people coming forward with their stories, and so they're, you know what, they're shrinking, they're losing their power, which is good. I mean, and there is a need for some sort of service to watch out for children who are being harmed or abused, but you know, perhaps the shift should be family preservation as opposed to child protection.
Yeah,
I think the funding is going to the in the wrong direction.
Yes. And the minister just announced recently when she, like, you know, now they've got the Independent Child Advocate Act coming out.
Right, right.
Pardon me?
No, I said right.
Yes, yeah. And now I notice the minister is carefully wording things when she says, now instead of just saying the child protection system, she's saying the child welfare and protection system.
Ah, okay.
I'm hoping there's some kind of a shift happening, and, you know, because she mentions, too, in one of her press releases, policies and programs are going to be providing assistance to families. So this, you know, we're going to have to watch it, but I'm hoping that this is where it's going, is into the preservation instead of
the apprehension
and,
yeah,
you know,
and constant removal,
yes,
yeah, of children. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the ministry itself has admitted on Hansard as well that kids move on average every 18 months or 22 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I know that there's been, this article that just came out the other day, in November, about the audit on CASs.
Yes.
And how they're misspending money, and so, you know what, they're being exposed now, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. It's coming slowly but surely. You know, they can't get away with it forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in the report they were talking about them spending a $50,000 SUVs?
Yeah,
and
trips. And yeah,
vacations to the Bahamas or wherever it is.
Exactly. Well, the one that jumped out at me was money that was granted to implement programs,
mm-hmm,
and those programs never came.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't wait to get my hands on that report.
I bet.
It's going to be and it's good, actually, that the ministry did change, like this current government, they did give the auditor, is it the auditor general?
It's provincial.
Provincial,
so,
yes.
Yeah.
They gave them the power to look into children's aid societies. So, I mean, that is a good thing. We have to acknowledge that, of course.
Exactly.
Encourage it, because, mm-hmm, you know, those files are the biggest thing. One of the things I think is important, too, is they can't just look at files, because we don't know how they're selected. You know, are the workers going and picking the ones that aren't so bad, and you know, I don't know the process.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, you can't just go by files. When they do reviews, they should be talking to kids in care and former kids in care.
Right.
Should be some way to maintain contact with them.
Exactly, but they don't want that.
No.
Because then they have
true
to deal with it.
Yeah. Now, the Auditor General might.
Yeah.
The ministry, of course, wouldn't be maintaining contact information. Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah, but child welfare belongs to the ministry. I think that's part of the big problem. Adoption and foster care is the Ministry of Community and Social Services' oldest institution.
Right.
Right? That's their baby.
Yes.
So they don't want to destroy that.
Mm.
You know, that's what brings in the big bucks.
Yeah.
So they're going to be very, very careful. Okay, John, we've got to wrap up in a minute. I just wanted to ask you, you know, for people who are listening who are in foster care right now or just have recently been, and I hate this term, but it's what it's called, and that's terminated from foster care. What do you want to say to them?
I'm looking back now. I would say that if you are out of care and you are upset about it, or you don't want other kids to go through what you went through, is to get involved, like do something either through myself at afterfostercare.ca or through your own ways, you know, get in touch with your agency and just try to get your records. That should get you inspired.
or know? Really, really frustrated.
Yes. I mean, yeah. Just to experience it, I would encourage anybody. Like, there's actually some people in the legislature who are in care. Mm-hmm. And I've written to them and asked, I said, why don't you go and try and get your records and, you know, mm-hmm. just to see what treatment you'll get. And don't mention you're an MPP.
Right, exactly. You know? Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Classism. I mean, it's
yeah.
There's no doubt in my mind that an MPP would get their records.
No.
With all the information not whited out.
Right.
And what about, too, about not being alone? I think in adoption and foster care, all our brothers and sisters out there, one of the biggest issues is that everybody feels so alone.
Yes.
With their experience and their pain. How do you cope with that?
Well, it's a divide and conquer sort of mentality that they work with, the agencies and stuff. But I think what we need to do is get together, like you're saying, totally, form groups, you know, if it has to be done by, you know, even ridings or however you want to do it. But that's something I'd like to do in time. And potentially even an annual gathering, you know, of people who've been in care. Let's get together at Queen's Park or wherever and start letting our voices be heard.
Right. Yeah, have a picnic and you know.
Yeah, I mean, this is what
your
website first said, was if we're not family, who is?
Yeah.
You know?
Actually, you know what, John, instead of Queen's Park, go to Parliament Hill in Ottawa.
Oh, yeah?
Let the federal government know. Mm-hmm. Why not?
That's something we need to know. I need to learn is how to make the connection between the federal and the provincial.
Right,
and I guess it's through funding. Transfer payments.
Yeah, child welfare is run by the provinces, mm-hmm. but doesn't mean the federal government can't know what's going on, right?
Yeah.
Okay, John, just amazing, amazing work that you're doing and the fact that you walked from Ontario to New Brunswick just to raise awareness about children's aid societies and the damage that they've caused and continue to cause is just awesome. Just
yes, thank
awesome.
You. And,
great. You're a great inspiration to many.
I appreciate being on the show, and I hope more people tune in and get active.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta do.
Me too.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
Great.
Okay, again, that was John Dunn. Thanks so much, John, for everything you do. And to reach John Dunn, you can go to his website at www.afterfostercare.com. And he's always around, and he'll help you out if you have a problem with the Children's Aid Society, your kids are in care, you risk losing your kids to care, you grew up in the foster care system, John would be more than happy to hear from you. So thanks again, John. All right, let's listen to a song by a friend of mine. His name is Heinz Klein, and he has written and produced his first CD called Mr. Bittersweet. And Heinz has been around in Toronto for a long time, helping people in the homeless community and people living with mental illness. So he's just quite a guitar player and very talented man. So let's listen to My Journal.
My journal's in a secret place. It's written on subway walls. Never less thing expending rubber bands. The carmine memories of love and someone special after are written on the wrinkles on your knuckles. And smoke drifting through your dirty black hair. My journal's in a secret place. It's written on subway walls. An everlasting expanding rubber band. Faces, the letters I wrote are engraved in clouds of garbage. Smoke and rave that pierce the street, that pierce the heart of the night. And run free like ancient yellow bats and yelling dogs in back alleys turning. My journal's in a secret place. It's written on subway walls. An everlasting expanding rubber band. bombing down, up out again, Evelyn screams, out my message like a melody.
All right, now we have Jesse McVicker. Jesse was raised in Calgary and went through the child welfare system, foster care system in Calgary, and he went into care at the age of 9. So Jesse on this Christmas Eve is going to talk about his experience growing up in a foster care. So hi, Jesse.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for coming on the show.
No, well, thank you for having me here.
No problem. You know, I've heard so many stories, horrendous stories about people growing up in foster care. I hear them from teens, from adults, and it's just, it's the same thing over and over and over. And you've been doing a lot of work in the past few years, bringing awareness to foster care issues, correct?
Yes, I have.
Yes, okay. And that's great to know. So people listening, you know, there are lots of advocates out there who are willing to hear your story and understand what it is you've gone through and are going through now. So listen up to Jesse. He's going to tell you a story. Can you talk about when you first went into care, Jesse?
Yeah. Well, I remember being, my parents took me out of school. It was in the middle of the day, and they brought me to this office, and I remember the conversation between my parents. I don't remember. I just remember me being referred to as a problem child. And something, they were talking about a 3-month contract. I remember the basic thing. And then the social worker looked at me and said, "Don't worry, you'll be seeing your mom again in 3 months, blah, blah, blah." And my mom and my dad, or my stepdad, they left, and I was left with the social worker. She told me that she was going to bring me to this nice place where these people were going to be really nice to me, and they were going to help me set up my bedroom, and they're going to get me into a new school. And it was, you know, I don't know how to explain it. It was scary, but it was exciting all at the same time.
Oh, an adventure.
Yeah, well, here, where I grew up, like, my parents were, I was a problem child. It was nothing to do with my parents, and there was nothing my parents could have done about it. I didn't manage to get control of that until I was, like, 13 or 14. So, but when I got into care and I realized I wasn't going to see my parents again, I began to freak out and try and get out of the group home. Well, at 9 years old, I'm tackled by these two big, I don't know, they just seemed monstrous to me at the time. They just tackled me and, like, it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, you know, less than 25 minutes ago, this lady's telling me I'm going into this really nice place and these people are really nice to me. Well, so 25 minutes later, I'm being tackled to the ground because I want to go home and I want to see my mom.
Was this by people who worked in the group home?
Yes, this was by group home staff.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, these staff were taught different methods of restraints and stuff like that. And, you know, apparently 9 years old doesn't matter. You're in a group home, you're restrained.
Right. Okay.
I think they've since developed some kind of policy where they don't put young kids into care anymore,
mm-hmm.
because of stuff like that. But, I mean, there's no way to tell or know, but I've heard mention that they don't do that anymore.
Okay, now you said a couple of times that you were a problem child.
Oh, yes.
Okay. What exactly does that mean, Jesse?
Well, I had a temper control problem, mm-hmm. even as a child, to the point where I would freak out and I would smash walls and I would pull stuff off tables, I would kick stuff over, I would pull stuff off hangers, I would knock pictures off walls. I don't know what was wrong with me. And people are like, well, you know, you can't say there's nothing wrong with a kid. Well, there becomes a point in time when you can say, when you turn into an adult, and one half of your brain is very, very intelligent and knows that you're doing something wrong, but the other half of your brain seems to not have any control.
Okay.
You know, you begin to ask questions and go see people. Well, I've come to learn, I had some, you know, I still have these issues, but you, after you take a long time and work on them, you can begin to deal with them. Well, as a child, you don't have these skills, and if no one can help you identify these problems,
yes, good point,
and be a problem child, and that's why these services are supposed to be there, to help you identify when kids have problems, emotional, like, okay, yeah, some traumatic stuff might have happened in my life, but, you know, my parents never really did anything serious to me, you know, like, okay, I got locked in my room and they yelled at me a lot, but I mean, considering that I was lighting, you know, chairs on fire and stuff, I think they were being pretty nice about it.
Okay.
But when they didn't know what to do, they brought me to social services, and they were supposed to help, and then I never seen my parents again.
So how old are you now?
I'm 28.
28? And when is the last time that you saw your parents?
When I was 9.
You're kidding.
No, I've never met. I was told by them they didn't they didn't want me, and they weren't going to come back. Like, I remember her name was Sylvia, and she brought me downstairs, and she was like, "Hi, Jesse, and I have something I need to tell you, blah, blah, blah." She told me that your parents aren't going to be coming to get you. This was the end of the 3 months. I was like, and she told me that they didn't want me. That's what she told me.
Mm-hmm. How
awful. Talk about having problems already when I got into care.
Of course.
Oh, all of a sudden, the whole world was my enemy and nobody was my friend.
Yes.
Only because I realized I'm getting tackled by staff, getting restrained. When other kids attack me and I go to defend myself, we're both restrained. You know,
yes.
Like, this is a common thing, like, once, twice a day, three times a day, sometimes, you know, like, these kinds of things aren't really told by people, and I could see why they wouldn't be very proud to admit, well, I freaked out and had to be restrained by 5 staff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I haven't seen them, and there was, you know, they wanted me. I've talked to them since. They didn't give me up. They fought in court and were beat in court. And my sister, who I've talked to, I was about care about 5 or 6 years, and then she entered care. I'm not sure what exactly happened. I never really got to find out much, but I did get to talk to her. The group home and the group home that she was in out in New Brunswick hooked us up with a phone call so we could talk to each other.
Okay.
And she had told me that my mom had been trying to get me, and that the courts beat, and then the social worker had used her children, because they just took me. They left my brothers and my sister there.
Mm-hmm.
My sister's... I think she was about 13 at the time, and my brothers were twins. So twins aren't adoptable.
Okay.
But I was really cute and small, so they
right.
took me.
But you were 9.
I was 9.
Right, okay. And so you were supposed to be adopted.
Yes, and I went into a few adoptive homes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the foster parents were, the adoptive parents were informed about us very well. Because I think they were expecting an angel, and they got a monster. And I was out of that home in a month.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to talk about rejection messing you up? These people say, "I'm going to be your mommy and daddy," and the next month they're giving you up.
Right.
You know, I think I was in about 5 different adoptive homes like that, but apparently my issues were too much, so they didn't want me.
Okay.
So I wasn't the poster child that they were promised.
Yeah, well, it's not you, it's them. So what happened when you went into care? Like, okay, one thing I'm curious about did they tell you the reason you were removed from your parents' home was because of you? Like, where did you get this information from?
Well, I never really got the information. What I gathered was I was forced to go see this psychologist named Sandy. She was in a wheelchair. She was a really, really nice lady. But she would sit here in this big office, but they had a big room and a table, and they had these water toys, and they had a big closet full of toys. And this Sandywood lady would get me to sit down and play toys, and she started asking me, "Well, do your parents touch you like that?" I'm not, like, exaggerating at all, like, you know.
Okay.
And then she kept asking me, and she kept asking me, and she kept asking me, and if I didn't say yes,
mm-hmm.
she didn't stop asking me.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're telling me, "Well, they did this. Did they beat you? Did your parents ever... spank you, blah, blah, blah." Well, yeah, they spanked me on the bum.
Mm-hmm.
Not like a smack where they take a wooden spoon and beat your butt. They spanked me like I was a kid.
Yes.
Like my grandparents spanked my parents and them before them. And
mm-hmm. Discipline,
you know?
Discipline, yeah.
Yeah.
So do you feel that she was pressuring you into giving a statement, like in retrospect, right?
Well, as I got older, I kept seeing the psychologist. I found out later on that there was a videotape behind this big glass mirror while I was playing with this psychologist lady.
Mm-hmm.
So I can imagine how they got what they wanted to get my parents not be able to have custody of me.
Right.
Must have been very, very, very easy to put a kid in a room without anybody there and pound on him information that wasn't...
Yeah, that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of this a few times. I'm not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the equivalent of brainwashing. I'm 9 years old. I don't... You know, it didn't make any sense to me.
Right, exactly.
It was a day.
And so you have no recollection of being abused with your parents?
No, I was locked in my room, but I mean, I'm going to set your couch on fire. Where are you going to put me?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like really since dealt with those things. You know, I'm Microsoft certified systems freak now, so I'm, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but when I was a kid, it was like I was like in a bubble, you know, I didn't actually have control of myself, and I was just watching this life go around me, and I just did what everybody told me to do.
Yes, yes. Oh, geez, I even remember growing up, there were always kids in school, kids I knew at school or whatever, who had really bad tempers.
Yep.
And they acted out. And, whether it had something to do with the family or not, I mean, definitely there was something that needed to be dealt with.
Yep.
And so, yeah, just simply removing a child from their home and saying that it's just for 3 months, and now it's 20 years later.
Well, my temper actually got worse as I progressed through care. It got to the point where I think at a school in grade, Clinton Ford Elementary School in Calgary, I think would have been grade 3, it took 6 teachers to restrain me to the ground, and a janitor, and a 500-pound principal.
Okay.
It was like something, you would think at this point in time they would begin to think, okay, maybe something's chemically wrong with him. Mm-hmm. Maybe we need to be looking into this.
Right.
Instead, when my school threatened to look into it, they just said something to my school, and my school backed off. Like, that was the same way I passed, too. Like, I never passed a grade on my own.
Okay.
Holy smokes. I brought my cards home, and all I ever seen was D's and 10% and 20% and failure. But then, magically, when the next school year came, I was in grade 5.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exaggerating to you. I didn't even know how to read or write till I was, like, 18.
Right. Yeah, there's kids that are streamlined through the school system.
Mm-hmm.
So how many homes were you in from 9 till 18, I guess? Because 18 is when care is terminated,
well,
right?
I don't know.
Mm.
I don't. more than 20?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I remember there was 3 placements in my first year. There was a Huntington Hills, there's a Huntington Hills, the Clinton Ford area, the way out in Sandy Hill area. This is out by Anderson Station. I remember that was just the first year. It was like 3 or 4 places, and then I went to this place called Magda Agency, and from there, that was a group home basically where that I was kept in, and while they tried to sell me.
They tried to sell you?
Well, that's what adoption is. They take you, they put you in a nice family, the family likes you, they pay the cash, and you're adopted.
Mm-hmm.
They pay administration fees, I'm sorry, but it turns out to be about $20,000.
Right. And
so they just basically, they house you in this group home until, if they can't sell you, then by about 16, they try to get you out and put you in a shelter so that they can make room for more kids.
Okay.
So if you're not adopted, you're, like, pretty much turfed onto the street by the time you're 16.
Right.
They do offer the whole, if you're in school thing, you can stay on assistance and they'll pay for your rent and all that. But I mean, that's sort of a new thing that wasn't around when I was a kid.
Right, okay. And so when you were 18 then, or at what age did you, because I know you told me before that you ended.
Well, I took off and lived on the streets most of my, streets and jail for, I think, from about 14 to 18.
Okay. And what was life like on the streets?
Scary, lonely, cold. I found out that the world is a very disgusting place and people are very mean and twisted. Sorry, can be. Not are. Can be. I found out that nobody was my friend. I found out that even the nice person who said, hi, blah, 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 the only reason why they want to buy you lunch is because next they're going to proposition you.
Mm-hmm.
I found that police were the people I had to be the most scared of. I found that I couldn't trust anybody to talk to anybody, to tell anybody, or to ask anybody for help because I literally watched my peers get nabbed right out of the street and they get tackled, like, right by staff in the middle of broad daylight, and they get taken back to their group home and no one would ever hear how we were being molested by one of the staff or, when we ran for a reason. We didn't just run to go live outside in the cold and freeze our butts off.
Yes.
If a kid's going to run away and live on the streets and eat garbage, there's obviously a problem.
And there's obviously a reason, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I don't even know how to describe my experiences, but I can tell you that I'm probably pretty scarred for life and I should have been in school.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. The whole thing is just mind-boggling, Jesse, yep. Honestly. Like, I mean, the fact that you're here today talking on the show is, to me, just fantastic. It's testimony to your, that you're a survivor. That you're, and that you're out helping other people as well.
Well, a lot of people don't like me, but I think they're probably the ones who want foster care to remain the same, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people that don't like me either. Anytime that you speak the truth and people don't want to hear it, they don't like you.
I've noticed that.
Yeah. Funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, and so what was it like on the street? Like, what is the pattern here?
Survival.
Foster care. Yeah, survival. Okay, I understand that, yep. But there's so many stories of foster kids who end up on the street. What is happening with our child welfare system?
Well,
how is this happening?
Well, you got to think about it. If kids are getting molested in their homes, or they're getting abused, or they're getting yelled at, or they're getting treated like crap, well, I know it sounds sick and twisted, but kids can find what they're looking for on the street. It's very, very, very twisted versions of it, but it's there. And so, you know, a kid figures, you know, if I'm going to be molested, I might as well get paid for it.
Okay.
Like, you know, kids show, like, a kid who's been in care from, like, age 14 to 17 is going to pass on what he's learned.
Yes.
To the new kids that have come into the group home. So, you know, you can imagine how shocked I was when I had a 17-year-old kid tell me when I was 14 years old that I was taken from my parents. My parents wanted me, and that if I will never be a free person if I ever... How did he phrase it? I'm trying to think of... He basically said, if I ever want to have kids, forget it. They will take every kid.
Right.
And my parents are apparently... I don't remember how he said it to me, but like it sent me into tears.
Sort of. Is it maybe something like once you're in the system, you never get out?
Yeah, it was something along the lines of that, but he was like... I think he's pretty drugged out, so a lot of it, you know, I can't be sure that he was entirely coherent about what he was saying to me, but I got the gist of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it scared the crap out of me, and basically his thing was run.
Hmm.
Those were his words to me, run. And then I later found out his name was Chad. He later threw a radio in the bathtub and electrocuted himself in New Era Group Home.
Mm-hmm.
It was in Calgary. I think I was just... Yeah.
How many suicides and deaths are there, do you think?
I don't know.
How many have you seen?
I don't know. Anybody that I was in care with, I only know two of them are alive today. And I know about 36 kids. I know two of them are alive for sure today. I've had a lot of friends that I met that were from here in Ontario that were from foster care, and we lived on the streets, and they never quite made it out.
Right. And what is the child welfare system doing about this?
Nothing. They're well aware that 30% of all the kids are living on the streets at any given time.
Yes.
They're very acceptable. I mean, when you go to the drop-in centers, these kids, when they sign in and they have to use them for the first time, there's a question, a little checkbox that says, are you from the foster care system? That has been on there since I was, like, 16, 17, going to these places. And all these street kids, you know how often I've seen that box? Like, every sheet, there was, like, maybe two spaces that weren't checked.
Okay.
Where all the names were filled out for everybody who signed in. And it's been like that since I can remember. So the government obviously has records of this.
So they're keeping statistics. Yeah.
Now, I'm gonna say something. I don't know. It might seem a little, you know, I might be a little off, but I was one of the first squeegee kids here in Ottawa. I'm one of the ones who started the whole phenomenon. And I went to the prostitution corners and told other kids that this is disgusting. Why are you doing this when you can pick up a squeegee and do this?
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, in under a year and a half, all the little CS kids and me and other people who weren't CS kids, but, you know, our parents didn't do whatever, we ended up with there, started filling up all the street corners, and you started seeing hordes of us, 10, 15 of us on squeegee corners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, all of a sudden, if you want to find Children's Aid Society's missing kids, look on the street corners. It took them a while to figure out where all these kids were and where all these squeegee kids were coming from. The minute that they figured out all of their kids can be found on street corners begging for change,
mm-hmm.
the Safe Streets Act was introduced, no questions asked.
Oh, wow.
All of a sudden, we can't squeegee, we can't panhandle. All of a sudden, the police have the right to grab any one of us at any time. Grab us, search us, no nothing, no reason, no anything. It gave them the right to raid squats and grab street kids, CAS kids. Mm-hmm. I watched some of these raids myself firsthand. Now, these were done by police. Apparently, there was drugs in the squats. That was the reason for coming in. They suspected drugs.
Okay.
and all of a sudden all these kids are grabbed and people, and it's Ottawa. A little while ago, Ottawa was infested, was just infested with street kids. The Ottawa police did a good job of chasing them all out, using the Safe Streets Act as their ability to just walk into anybody and do whatever they want. This is like, I don't know, all of a sudden every street kid that I knew disappeared. I watch street kids that I've seen that grew up in foster care and then hit the streets and were trying to actually almost becoming, they were making themselves something, you know, like they were doing something with their lives, taking their money and buying books and going to school. I knew one squeegee kid who was saving his money and going to a hotel management course.
Mm-hmm.
These kids were all of a sudden, poof, they have nothing, and it's illegal for them to ask for help now.
So the one little thing, effort that they put into trying to improve their life or whatever was taken from them.
All they had.
Mm-hmm.
All they've ever had.
What about their parents? So you're in care for 16 or 17 years, presumably have lost contact with your parents, your family,
yeah.
But you know your name.
Yeah.
And perhaps some background information on your siblings and your parents. So the idea of finding your family is
why?
Just...
Why? So they can realize what a letdown you are, and most of these kids think that their parents didn't want to talk to them in the first place. Most of these kids think that their parents abandoned them.
Right.
They're not going to go looking for them.
Okay.
It's like the ultimate rejection, and no street kid who's been through that or foster kid who's going to be through that is going to set himself up as an adult for it again.
Mm-hmm. Well, why put yourself through that?
Sucker for punishment. We've seen a few of those.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
Okay, that makes sense. Definitely. And then the ones who do try, such as John Dunn, who, you know, went back to the Catholic Children's Aid Society to get his information, and it's 5 years later, and he's still fighting with them to get his own information.
And I have a feeling that when he gets his information, he's going to find there's stuff missing.
Yes. Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Oh, I found stuff missing out of my file.
But I guess my point, too, though, Jesse, was that the Children's Aid make it so difficult for you to get any information anyway, so you give up.
Well, I think the problem might be is that they don't have it organized to be able to find everything. It's probably such a chaotic mess back there. Like, I'm a computer person, so I can just imagine. I know how systems flaw every day. I know how bugs and quirks and, you know, these guys are fast-fooding kids, like, beyond speeds without going into homes, without doing visits. They're, like, just doing paperwork, not even looking at the child and just making sure the paperwork's done.
Right.
And this is, like, to the point where... even if we had access and we were allowed, I don't think they could probably give us all the information because I don't think they probably know where it all is.
Yes.
Which is probably a good reason, which is probably one of the main reasons why when the court said you need to produce these documents, they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much that they wanted to hide anything, it's that they just couldn't.
Yes, exactly. And what about the recent story that broke the news about CAS is being audited?
I think it's just a smokescreen.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a much bigger problem. And I think this is the whole foster care going down makes the government look just as bad because they're just as guilty as the foster care system because they decided to pass the buck on to somebody else and then didn't bother to monitor that somebody else to make sure that we were safe. And now they're scratching the surface and finding out that, okay, yeah, they're pretty much worried about their money and don't seem to really care about the kids. Or,
yes.
You know, when these workers aren't going to the homes, okay, well, these kids are hitting the streets. Because they're not going to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
A kid will only take so much abuse before he will leave.
Right.
I mean, some stay, but that's depending on how bad it is for them. Some don't have the mental ability to know that they're being victimized.
Right.
And it's, you know, and if these workers are, you know, so behind on their things and they're not doing anything and, you know, the kids are popping up starved in cages while these people are taking trips out to, like, the Caribbeans. Well, like Jeffrey Campbell's found his, you know, I'm sure, you know, maybe taking $20 of that, gone to see Jeffrey, see how he's doing, and give him a meal.
Right.
Boy, he might not have starved so quick.
Yes.
I know it sounds cold, but, you know, people are, like, trying to, like tiptoe around this, like, well, it was the parents' fault. Well, no, it was everybody's fault who was in his life who didn't make sure that he was safe.
Yes.
That's the courts, the judge, that was the judge who sent the kid to live in the home, because the judge has to approve these kinds of decisions. So if the judge should have noticed that there wasn't enough information done and, you know, like when all these things are being backpedaled and, you know, things are being shortcutted and paperwork's not getting done, I can just imagine the impacts it would have on the kids. And it doesn't seem, everybody seems to be thinking about that part of it.
Exactly.
Like, how many kids are being taken that shouldn't be taken because these people are just trying to fill quotas for money they're spending that they can't account for.
Yes.
You know, it's scary. Like, you know, if these people are willing to steal from children and they're willing to lie, and they're willing to lie right to the very, very bitter end, and then continue to try to pretend like they have, you know, some kind of respect among anybody, you know, and the government's like, oh, well, we're going to introduce a new legislation to make sure they don't abuse money. But there's no mention of, what about the abuse of the kids? What about all the kids living on the street and the ones that should be in homes and schools, but social workers never get there? Mm-hmm. Some places just aren't called at all, as they said in the report. So
yeah.
When you have a mess like that, you know, money is like the last thing these people should be even looking at. They should be doing a check on all the kids, first of all and foremost. And you would think, you know, after this kind of a thing would surface, that this is just some of the things all the advocates were talking about. This is basically the harmless stuff that we were talking about. So they're taking responsible for all the harmless stuff, but not, you know, it's like copping to the lower plea, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make sense. It's not okay. I mean, there are certain things where the only thing I have from my past are my horrors. And so the only thing I get to keep is my souvenir. So I know it sounds a little weird, but I try to keep those kinds of things to myself. They're the only place that they'll ever be forgotten.
Right. I understand. Thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing your story through the foster care system. And thanks for the work that you're doing to help other people who've been through foster care to understand what it is they're going through.
At least I can do.
I'm sure it's the least you can do, Jesse. All right. Thanks, Jesse McVicker, for coming on the show. And let's listen to some U2 with Where the Streets Have No Name. And we'll be back with Erica. Okay, now we have Erica Klein on the line. Erica is a former Crown Ward in Ontario in Canada. She is also an author of a book called Stolen and is a mother. So Erica is going to share with us her journey through the foster care system and also how she came to lose her own children to the same system. So hi, Erica.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Okay, very interesting life you've had so far, huh?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. It's been unbelievable.
Mm-hmm, I bet. Okay, so we've heard from two adults, survivors of foster care, and so now we'd like to hear from, you know, obviously you're a survivor of foster care as well, but also from the mother's point of view, losing her kids to the system. So can you start at the beginning?
So start with my own experience.
Sure.
Well, when I was 13 years old, our family experienced some problems and we had a breakdown, and I wanted to get some counseling for my family. So my parents were never abusive. There was just some trouble in our family, and I thought as a young teenager that if we could get some kind of counseling that our family may be able to heal and be a healthy family. But what happened was that I was apprehended, and I didn't see my mother for 5 years, and I bounced through the system from home to home. So in fact, basically I asked for services and help for my family, but that help never materialized.
So, okay, so you called the Children's Aid Society then?
Yes, I did.
And you said, my family is experiencing, you know, this, that, this and that, and how can you help us?
That's right.
Okay, so the next thing you know, they're showing up at your door taking you away.
Basically, yeah.
Any other siblings in the family?
Yes, I have one older sibling, but he was 16 at the time, so they weren't interested in him because he was old enough to live on his own.
Okay. And so how did your family react to that?
They were very angry with me. They thought I was calling the government or the cops on them. They didn't understand that my intention was to get our family services and not to separate us and not to blame them, but just to get us some help. So they didn't take it very well.
Right, okay. And so then you went into foster care, and were you allowed contact with your family?
Yeah, I had access to my family, but I think just from their point of view, they were being blamed for a lot of stuff, and it was just a very stressful time for them. So my mother and I lost contact altogether, but my father, he was keeping track of me. I mean, I thank God for my father every day. He kept track of me through every home I went to. He always tried to find me and make sure I was okay.
Okay.
So.
And what was, what were the various homes like that you were living in?
A few of them were okay. You know, like they were pretty decent, but a lot of them were horrible. Some foster homes were filthy, dirty. We weren't included in what went on in the home. Basically, dinner was in the pot. You got leftovers. You weren't allowed to eat with them. If they went away for the weekend, we would get thrown out. Basically, fend for yourself. This weekend, we're out. And I ran away a lot because I needed to eat and I needed to survive. And in a lot of these places, they weren't providing the basic necessities to us.
Right. Okay. And so, why were you shipped around so much?
I guess the Children's Aid would like to say that I was a teenager and very hard to place, but I think my only crime was wanting better, was wanting a good home, and so I guess because I ran from a lot of bad places, they would like to say it was me that didn't make the places work out.
Right.
But some of the group homes that I stayed in were really scary, and sometimes the streets are a better alternative to the hell you're living in Children's Aid.
Mm-hmm.
So.
No, I've heard that for sure. And also, did you move around Ontario?
Mostly around the GTA. basically from Mississauga all the way to Oshawa.
Right, okay. Because I've heard, and I don't know if this is correct, that Children's Aid Societies get paid, like when a child goes into a different jurisdiction, that is now a per diem for that particular Children's Aid Society.
Well, they move their wards all over Ontario. I lived in a group home where there were kids from North Bay, there were kids from Niagara Falls, London. They are known to just move kids around quite a bit.
Oh boy, what an experience. So then at what age were you, and I have to use this term because it's their language, is terminated from care?
Well, when I turned 16, they put me in an independent living home. And because I feel that I was institutionalized, I felt that I was kept away from regular society for 3 years of my life, where I never had contact with the real world. I wasn't given any life skills. I went to so many different high schools that by the time I turned 16, when it was time for me to go live out on my own, it was just extremely overwhelming. And so they tried to help me with an independent living program, and I had a hard time adjusting to society, and I had trouble going to school, I had trouble getting a job, because being around normal people was just really hard for me. And in the end, they asked me to leave their program, and so that's how I ended up living on the streets. And I lived on the street for about 8 months straight.
Wow.
And they knew I was out there, and they never told me, oh, here's a shelter or here's a program. They basically just said, you're not following our rules, you can leave.
Right.
So I didn't finish my involvement with CAS completely until I turned 21.
Okay, so you were still with them on paper?
Yes.
Okay, got it. And and I've heard from our other two guests, especially Jesse, talking about the horrendous life on the street.
Yeah.
And what that was like for him and for so many kids coming out of foster care. People have no idea, do they?
No, they have no clue. They just see all these teenagers outside and they figure we're rebellious, we don't want to follow the rules. Most people have no idea that we're coming from some pretty tough situations.
Right. Was it possible for you, or did you try to locate your family when you were 16?
Well, like I said, I thank God for my dad, because he was able to stay in touch with me. So even when I was out on the street, he would come and find me. You know, so I was really lucky that I had at least one person who kept track of me.
Right.
But he wasn't able to look after me. But he did, you know, check on me and take me out for meals or lend me some money.
Right.
But I didn't speak to my mother until I had my first child, which was some years later. So.
Okay. So let's skip ahead a bit. What was the transition from the street to living on your own, or how
did basically that... when I became a mother. I was 19 when I was pregnant with my first child, and for me, getting pregnant changed my whole world. I now had a life inside of me that I had to think about, and so I changed my life. I wanted to live in my own apartment and raise my baby, and that meant leaving the streets, and that's what I did.
Okay, and how did you do that? Did you get a job? Did you get social services?
I got basically help from welfare and social services, and I lived with a friend of mine's parents for a while I was pregnant, and basically that's when the harassment started as a parent, how it shifted from being a youth in care to a parent having problems with CAS.
Right.
And unfortunately, I lost the child's father. He died while I was pregnant, so that really didn't help me very much.
Oh, goodness, no.
So, but I did end up getting my own apartment, and I fended them off pretty well. I mean, they were always coming around trying to catch me doing something, or, you know, they wanted to take my baby from me simply because I was young and on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky to have kept her.
Right.
So
good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also there's such a big market for infant adoptions, right?
Oh, of course. And mm-hmm. I mean, when I gave birth, I had social workers in my room tearing me apart, saying, your husband or your partner is dead and you live on welfare, and how are you going to raise this baby? And I basically said, get out of my room.
Yeah.
Get out. I don't see you bothering any other parents here, you know?
Right. And where was this?
At Women's College Hospital.
Oh, God. So when you were giving birth?
Like the next morning, you know, they come in your room and instead of saying, how can we help you do a better job as a parent, or how can we support you, it was, how are you going to do this?
Yes.
And they just pick a very vulnerable time, and it's the most memorable time. You've just given birth to your first child, and instead of being offered support, you're being harassed, and you're being cut down, saying you're not good enough, basically.
Yeah.
And I was a pretty strong person. I just said, please leave my room.
Mm-hmm. And they did.
And they did.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of young women may not know they have that right.
Oh, happens all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was just a really strong person, and I always stuck up for my rights.
Right, exactly. Even in the hospital. Because that's,
I
always say that, is that when is a woman her most, well, not the most all the time, but how vulnerable is a woman after just giving birth?
Yeah, it's
you know?
Your hormones are fluctuating. It's highly emotional time, and they're maximizing on that. They're counting on you to, basically, most women want to be a good mother. You know, they capitalize on the fact that you want to be a good mother and you want to do what's best for your child, and unfortunately, Children's Aid thinks that's giving kids up for adoption. So they never stop to think that they could offer services to help keep mother and child together.
Exactly.
Somehow that's never an option.
I don't know. Some get it, but most don't.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's you just reminded me of a time I interviewed somebody at Rosalie Hall here in Toronto. Which
I know Rosalie Hall well.
Okay, yeah. It was one of the first maternity homes, right, where women went and lost their children to adoption. And now it's a big center for pregnant women and teens.
Well, and I almost stayed there when I was pregnant with my first child. I checked out Massey Center and Rosalie Hall, and I chose not to move there. I don't know why. I didn't have any proof. Nobody said anything, but my gut reaction was that if I stayed in these places, I wasn't going to walk out with my baby.
Yeah, you had a feeling.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And people said, you know, you're homeless. You need to find a place to live. And I said, I don't care. I'll stay with my friend's parents. I'll figure it out.
Yeah,
but I knew from a gut reaction that these agencies say they help women, but sure didn't feel that way.
Right, exactly.
When you walk through those doors.
How long ago did you have your daughter?
She was born in 97.
97.
She's going to turn 10 next month, and I still have custody of her.
Right, good. Good to hear.
Yeah.
That's excellent to hear, actually.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say about Rosalie Hall is that the program coordinator there was telling me, and I think they've changed even in the last 10 years. They offer a lot of programs to help moms keep their kids, like employment training and counseling and schooling and parenting skills. And unless I was like really, really fooled, I don't know, but it seemed pretty legitimate to me. But what she told me is that the workers there have to fight off the Children's AIDS social workers.
That's right.
They literally, they're like vultures.
Yep.
You know, hanging around the building, sneaking around. Yeah, I was just like, oh, that is so awful. But, okay, so go ahead then. So you
well, yeah, I basically was able to keep my oldest child, and I had another baby, a second daughter, 2.5 years later. And basically, I fell in love for the first time, and I was totally in love and happy to be having a second child. Unfortunately, her father didn't feel the same way, and he didn't want to be a father. So I was stuck, basically, to raise the two by myself. And when I ran upon hard times or I needed child support, he wasn't very supportive. So it was a really tough time in my life.
Okay.
And basically what ended up happening was I got into some kind of a conflict with welfare, and it was in the height of the Harris regime. So Mm-hmm. I happen to have children at the worst time politically.
I just want to say what the Harris regime is, because a lot of our listeners won't know what that means.
Oh, yeah. Mike Harris, the premier.
Exactly. He was the premier of Ontario from, I don't know, the 80s to about 2004. No, how long was he in power? 1994?
I think he was voted in 95.
95.
And he served, the Tory government stayed in for about 8 years.
Yeah, so a very, very strict conservative government who canceled all kinds of social programs and social housing and left a lot of people homeless.
Basically, and they cut the welfare rates down
so badly that
women like me, who are young mothers, had to make a choice between paying the rent or feeding their children. And that's sort of what happened to me, was I had to make a choice, and I couldn't look at those children and not feed them. And so what ended up happening was I fell behind in my rent, and eventually I was evicted. And I happened to get evicted in the middle of winter. So it was the dead of winter. I had a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, and basically 2 daughters under the age of 5. And I had to find a place to live. And I was so terrified of losing them to foster care, to adoption. That was always my main concern, was that the system wasn't going to help me. They were going to take apart my family. So in the end, I went to the CAS in the same manner I did many years before, where it was, I felt that I was being a responsible parent by asking for help. I think any good mother who's in a bad situation is going to try to get support or resources to try to fix things.
Yes, of course.
So it started off to be a voluntary agreement, and it turned into a huge child custody battle. And during that time, I was homeless, and I actually was sexually assaulted. So it was probably the darkest time in my life, because I'd lost my home, I lost my children, and I was raped. And at no point was the Children's Aid Society supportive. They simply looked to my children as commodities. Mm-hmm. And so, luckily, I was able to save my oldest child. And they wanted the younger child adopted. And that's exactly what happened.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Yeah, so...
So how old?
It was really painful.
Yes, of course.
It was never my intention. Adoption was never my choice. My own mother is an adoptee as well, so I kind of know what kind of damage it can do to adoption can do to people. Mm-hmm. You know, I know the long-term sort of effects. And while my trial was going on, I was terrified for my children, because I had been through foster care and I knew how horrible it was. I couldn't even sleep at night. I was so worried sick over them.
Right.
So.
How old was your daughter when she was adopted?
16 months old.
Oh, 16 months old, okay. And so did you agree to sort of a temporary placement?
Yeah, it was a 30-day temporary agreement so that I could get on my feet, get some money together, you know, set up my house. And then the idea was to take them back. But before those 30 days ended, they started accusing me of things that I never did. They just painted me as a monster. And because I was an ex-ward of the CAS, that only fueled the fire. Like, in terms of family court, they think because you were an ex-ward, you're worthless as a parent, which I find really disturbing, being that Children's Aid was responsible for me.
Oh, exactly.
You know, like, what does that say about their standard of care? I grew up in their system, and then they turn around and say, well, because you are in our system, you're not a good enough parent. I mean, that's just unreal.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, the assumption is that the person coming out of foster care is unstable.
That's right.
So if they've known this for, like, the last 100 years, why haven't they done anything about it?
Well, I think it's, as we've seen from the provincial auditor's report, this has nothing to do with the well-being of children. It has everything to do with the $1.4 billion they get in funding. Mm-hmm. And I firmly believe that.
Yes, they are funded by how many kids come into care and how many kids are adopted.
That's right.
So, of course, they are, you know, pushed or pressured into using unethical means to obtain children.
That's right. So they wouldn't know child abuse if it hit them in the face,
right,
as far as I'm concerned. Because they will attack somebody like me who was very teachable, very willing to get help, mm-hmm. very willing to cooperate, and strip me of my rights. Yet they'll leave kids like Randy Dooley, Baby Jordan, and the list goes on to die.
Yes, and Jeffrey Baldwin.
Mm-hmm. That's the proof that they're only interested in funding.
Right.
Because if they're interested in kids, they wouldn't even care about the money they're going to get. They'd be more interested in saving real abused children.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, a good friend of mine, Ann Patterson, said to me the other night that, you know, going into being involved with CASs, Children's Aid Societies, or Child Protection Services, ends up creating the abuse that it was supposed to prevent.
Well, here's where I'm coming from. I went to the system asking for help, and when I walked away, I was one less child. At no point was I helped. At no point, I did everything right, as a mother should do. I asked for help. I tried to set up resources. And by the time I was done, I was one less child, and I still had all the same problems that I went to them in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And the scary part is, there are mothers out there who have issues and won't ask for help now.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to be my situation, because all I learned from this experience was, don't trust anybody, don't ask for help, and a lot of women are suffering.
Yes.
In their own pain, because they can't admit that, oh, I might need counseling or I might need some help, because we'll be, you know, scrutinized and possibly lose our children over it.
Well, punished.
Yes.
Exactly.
And then there's a lot of families that are afraid to take their children to the doctor because they're afraid. And I have no doubt in my mind, had I been middle class or married, if I had a different social status, I would never have been treated that way.
Right, exactly.
So.
It's interesting you say that, Erica, because I worked at a Children's Aid Society here in Toronto just for two years. And when I worked there, I remember a worker freaking out because she had gotten a call to go to an affluent area in Toronto
mm-hmm.
to investigate an allegation of child abuse by a father. And I remember, distinctly her words. She goes, oh, my God, I hope he didn't really do it.
Huh.
You know, not about the, because of who he is and where they lived.
Yeah.
You know, they were more concerned about that than they were the actual abuse of the child.
Yeah, so. The bulk of their clients, and it says so on their own statistics, are poor people.
Of course.
They are poor people, they are single parents, they are working low-income families, they're minorities. They are definitely not looking for child abuse in all classes of society. Their main client base is poor people, people who can't afford a lawyer, people who can't afford the resources to keep Children's Aid away from their family.
Exactly. And like yourself, the former kids in care.
Oh, I just feel like I was put through a puppy mill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like I was bought and sold.
Boy, if only we could just, you know, let people know that if when you're out of foster care, run.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was 19 and when I first got pregnant, I had this crisis of conscience where I said, I wonder if I should tell my social worker. I could sign myself out of CAS and just go on welfare. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to put a little faith in the system, and I'm going to trust my social worker, because maybe if I tell my worker, they'll give me support. And I wanted to be a good mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the worst mistake I could have made. I mean, the smart thing would have been exactly what you said. You find out you're pregnant or you're finished with CAS, run. Don't go near them.
No, exactly.
And I wanted to believe in the spirit of Children's Aid. I wanted to believe that if I told them I was going to be a mother, they were going to be supportive.
Well, who can blame you for going to them? But who can, you know, I mean, it's a resource. They're supposed to be a resource for families.
That's right.
Like, I don't blame you one bit for reaching out to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you did what you thought you had to do to help your children and yourself.
That's right.
Yeah.
And for the last sort of 4 years, I've had to live with a nightmare of losing my daughter. And I have an older child who has suffered as well. Now, she, while the case was going on, they bounced her three times. She was 4 years old. They separated her from her sister. So she, not only did she lose her sister, she lost her mother, and she was living with strangers. I mean, that just was terrifying to this poor little girl.
Yeah.
I'm not even angry so much about what they did to me, but what they've done to these innocent children.
Right. And so it wasn't any kind of open adoption agreement?
Well, it was verbally, it was all verbal. It was basically like, you know, they made promises that we would have visits, that my older daughter and I could stay in touch and to have visits. And they even set up a visit.
Mm-hmm.
And when the time came for the visit, they backed out.
Of course.
So they told me, now you have to deal with her adoptive parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want any contact with us at all.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they now own my daughter. And they're not interested in honoring the agreement. But because it was never put in writing, there wasn't much I could do about it.
Right.
So,
oh, boy. Yeah.
I've gotten two pictures in the last 5 years. And I argue a lot with her adoptive mother. I know where she lives. I have her email. And I'm always trying to persuade her to do the right thing for this child.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not about me and it's not about her. It's about a child who's going to grow up with questions, real questions about her identity and who she is. And I just want her to know that I love her and never wanted to leave her.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
I think kids who are adopted need to know that.
Oh, absolutely.
If it's possible, you know?
Mm-hmm. And just, you know, as I'm adopted as well, right? And just listening to you tell your story about what happened to you and then what happened to you as a mother. And I was thinking, you know, I wish I had known my mother's story.
Yeah.
While I was growing up. Instead of all these, you know, pretty little stories. Oh, your mother was a university student and she got pregnant. Like, what does that mean?
My mother,
it's ridiculous,
didn't get told anything. They didn't tell her anything. They just said, you're special and we picked you.
Yeah.
And there was never a story.
No, exactly. So when adopted people reunite with their mothers, you know, years later, it takes a long time to understand that something, you know, that something really did happen. There were circumstances out of our mother's control.
That's right. And,
I know.
And once I got my older child back, I got stronger and I started doing advocacy and I started doing public speaking. And now I've made a record as many places as I can, be it the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star. I did some work at the legislature a few times where I gave speeches. And I almost want to leave a record as many places as I can for my daughter.
Yes.
So that it's not just her crazy birth mother saying, you know, I got messed over by these people. I'm leaving a real record.
Yes, exactly.
In as many legitimate places as I can so that she can see that it's true, you know.
Yeah, well, you're doing it right now.
Yeah, I am, I am.
No, you know, yeah, no, I think you're awesome. You're wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
And let's just hope that the adoptive mother kind
and
of
she's
sees
adopted
the light.
As well. I'm
oh,
like, there
grief.
Is too many adoptions going on in my world.
Yeah.
I'm just like, you know how in life sometimes the battles choose you? That's sort of how I feel.
That's interesting.
I feel like this whole thing chose me.
Right.
To be the person to talk about it and to raise awareness.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing a great job at it.
Yeah, I try to. I run a website called Mothers in Exile, and I get a lot of email from birth mothers. I don't even like to use the term birth mother, but we'll use it just because that's the word.
Oh, you can say mother.
Yeah, I get a lot of email from mothers from all over the place, and some of them are still grieving over the loss of their children. And I don't think anybody who wasn't normal could walk away from something like that and not feel that kind of pain.
Exactly.
So mm-hmm. I'm glad that my website's there. I get people thanking me because they found a relative through my links or so it's been good. I'm trying to spread the word.
Yes, good stuff. And you wrote a book called Stolen?
Yeah, I wrote a book. I finished it in 2003. And it's called Stolen, and it's basically my account of in detail of what I went through with my children. And I actually wrote it. I never thought about publishing it. I just wanted to write down my story for my daughters so that when they were older, they would be able to sit down and read it. And then I realized this experience is, I'm not alone in it, that there's other women across North America who've gone through it as well.
Yes.
And so now I'm trying to have the book published.
Okay, good. And yeah. you've also written, you're in the process of writing another book called The Valley Kids?
Yeah, and I think for some reason The Valley Kids is more marketable. I mean, adoption is an industry, and every time I sent Stolen to a publisher, they're like, we don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole,
mm-hmm.
you know, because a lot of their consumers are adoptive parents.
Right.
So it's, I think those issues, even in 2006, are still taboo about women having babies. You know, so Valley Kids is about the day in the life of a foster child. It's like memoirs. And what I'm hoping is that it will open a dialogue, that it will raise awareness to the general public and let them know what is going on behind closed doors.
Right. Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And also good for other kids going through the system right now, kids coming out of the system. You know, if there's literature out there for them to read, I mean, that's what helped so many of us, just the various books.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the internet came along, so, you know, you just
Internet
type.
Is amazing.
Yeah, I know. It's helped a lot of people, me included.
Well, these foster kids, and I include myself, we have no voice. There's nobody advocating on their behalf. And by the time they turn 18, they're lumped into society, and they have specific needs that need to be addressed. And until their voices are heard, it's just going to be that ugly cycle of poverty and of abuse by the system.
Exactly.
So.
And because of the way the system is funded,
mm-hmm.
right? The way they allocate money, that's obviously got to change. Shift it from child protection to family preservation or something.
Well, honestly, there's so many reforms that need to be made. And I look at this like a movement, just like the civil rights movement. And I feel like we're an infant. We're in its birth.
Yes.
And women from other generations are beginning to speak out about what they went through in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And change takes time, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's,
it is a movement, and even though we need a lot of reforms to be made, the first one is breaking the silence.
Exactly. And it's been about 100 years, right?
Yeah.
With our child welfare system and adoption and such. And you know what? I think 100 years is pretty much the norm for a lie to live.
Yeah.
You know, a lie can only live, a corrupt practice, socially unjust system. It can only go on for so long before the people who are affected by it start to scream.
That's right.
And I think that's what's happening now, is that it's been 100 years, so I think it's run its course.
Well, and I honestly think they need to get out of the business of adoption and family services. I think the Children's Aid Society's only mandate should be to investigate child abuse, period. And maybe a different agency, that an umbrella agency, something more friendly to service families,
right.
for that type of service.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should be completely separate, because it is a conflict of interest to be adopting out kids and apprehending kids and providing services. That is a conflict of interest straight across the board.
Right.
And they need to get out of the business altogether.
Well, they have too much power.
Oh, yeah. I know they've used the police, and I know that even when mothers talk about their stories publicly, that they can be put in jail by law.
Really?
Yeah, the Child and Family Services Act states that any case that goes on in family court has a media ban, has a publicity ban.
Mm-hmm. So they're given a gag order.
Basically, and they hide under the shield of confidentiality that it's for the best interest of the child. And I think that's just an excuse.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, I think it's an excuse to keep what they do a secret.
Yes.
And if they weren't afraid of what they were doing was right, then they shouldn't feel that way. And nobody wants to smear a child in the media, but the absolute silence it has to end.
Exactly.
It's the only way we can get change.
Exactly. So on this Christmas Eve, Erica, Mm-hmm. What would you like to say to anybody who's out there and listening to you and relating to you?
I know the holidays are quite a tough time of year for most people, but for natural mothers and adoptees, it seems to be adding salt to your wounds. And if you're a birth mother and you're out there and you're missing your child, I totally understand. I'm going through it too. And if you're an adoptee, just know that there is a story and that you are loved.
Okay, Erica. That's awesome. All right. Thanks a lot. And you have yourself and your daughter a wonderful Christmas.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. And that's it for another adoption show. Thanks so much to our listeners for joining us. And, of course, thanks to Erica, Jesse, and John for sharing their experiences and story and the wonderful work that they're doing in the foster care, for the foster care system, and just reaching out to people. So way to go, guys. All right, don't forget to hop into the chat room after the show, meet the guests, and chat it up with friends. Just click on the link that says chat room on any one of the pages on the Adoption Show website. And if you'd like to be a guest on the Adoption Show, email us at theadoptionshow@gmail.com, and Lily will be happy to coordinate a time and hear your story and such and set up an interview. And so that's to be a guest on the Adoption Show, or even to suggest a topic, contact us at theadoptionshow@gmail.com. The next show, we're actually going to be having a special show on December 31st, and we're going to be interviewing Assemblyman David Kuhn from Rochester, who will be, he is the official sponsor of the bill to unseal records. And so he will be discussing that bill, as well as Steve, an adopted person in New York who's also lobbying for the bill. All right, so that's December 31st at 8:30 p.m. If you can't catch it on that night because it is New Year's Eve, it will be available after 8:30 p.m. on the 31st. All right, Denise, Lily, Thaddeus, and I would like to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and of course, all the best for 2007. And that's about it. Now let's listen to some Mariah Carey with All I Want for Christmas Is You.
I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own. Make my wish come true.